Good morning. People want to take their seats. Please. Good morning. We're very pleased to welcome you to the new campus of the CUNY School of Public Health. And to introduce you to the first event of the New York City Food Policy Center here at our 125th Street campus. Is echo still going on? So maybe we'll try this. I've never been criticized for having too soft a voice. Some of you may have heard in the last few weeks, the CUNY School of Public Health has been restructured and is now a separate CUNY unit that brings together the campuses of Hunter, Brooklyn, Lehman, and the Graduate Center here. Eventually we'll be moving into this building, and we look forward to maintaining our commitment to our degree programs. We look forward to featuring our work on food policy here in New York City and other cities. And before I introduce our guest speaker, I just wanted to introduce the Dean of the School of Public Health, Dr. Ayman Al-Mohandes, to say a quick hello.
It shouldn't have anything to do with the echo.
Let me vote on your attendance echo in this remark. you're welcome here. This is the state at CUNY that is going to be dedicated for public health dialogue today and the future. As the open public school of public health, we identify ourselves as the relevant contributors to the health of the rest of the New York City nation. We hope that you understand that you don't go there. And Nick is a perfect example of our representative in the community that brings together people with public concerns, people with joint energy, people with new thinking, people with leadership. America has demonstrated over many, many, many years. We couldn't have a better person to be our inaugural speaker, because she brings with her goodwill, but also fierce advocacy. Public health today is challenged by a lot of political and economic variables that don't always place the public as a priority. And have a very proximal understanding of outcomes. And we, together, with a deeper understanding of how we are going to impact the future of this nation, need to put our energies together, our intelligence together, our advocacy together, and propagate the right message. This messaging needs to be evidence-based at many, many layers, not just the academic and scientific layer, but also the applied science layer. And there is no one better to represent the application of what we know about industry and its interface with the health of the public and Americans. So I welcome you here today. I'm very, very proud that Nick chose to have you as our first speaker in this space. And again, please come back, consider this your space. We are just holding it for you. And hopefully we can do a lot of good work together. So welcome you.
Thank you. We are particularly pleased to have this talk in this place because in the poor and black and Latino communities of New York City, we experienced a very heavy burden of diet-related diseases. And exploring public health is not an armchair discipline. It's a discipline that looks to understand dynamics in order to take action. And what better way to do that than to understand the role of the soda industry in producing health and disease here in Upper Manhattan, in Harlem, in East Harlem, in New York City, the nation, and of course the world. The book is Soda Politics. It continues Marion's long tradition of providing the evidence that fierce advocates with goodwill need to bring their messages forward. And we really welcome her to talk. The format for today's session is Marion's going to talk for about 40 minutes or so, and then we're going to have plenty of time for back and forth questions. And just in case you were wondering, the book is available at Barnes & Noble, Oxford Press, Amazon, and elsewhere. Marion.
So what's the, oh, I see what the microphone situation is. Thank you all for coming. It was an adventure to get here for a lot of us who aren't uptown very much. But thank you very much for inviting me and for letting me talk about my book here. I like to start by talking about why I wrote a 500-page book about soda and soda politics. And I think the reasons are pretty simple, although there are several of them. This is really a book about advocacy. I teach food politics, food policy, and food advocacy at NYU. I've been doing that for quite a long time. And I needed a book to use in my food advocacy class. I thought I might as well write one. And I'm indicating, I titled the book, Taking on Big Soda and Winning. And the parenthetical and winning is something that I really want to emphasize because I think there's a lot that's going on in advocacy around soda issues that's working really well. And I want to emphasize that. And so I've put these little thumbs up buttons on all of the places where I think we're making real progress. I want to start by saying that one of the questions that I get asked constantly is what does soda have to do with politics? And I can answer that in one slide. I'll just leave that. That was in Moscow in 1995. The soda industry is a worldwide industry, very, very deeply entrenched in developing countries. And there is an enormous amount of advocacy to try to encourage people to drink less soda. Many, many different organizations in many different places. So there's plenty to write about. So that was another reason for doing this. And then in public health terms, the sodas are low-hanging fruit. They're really, really an easy target. And the reason that they're an easy target is because they contain sugars, water, and flavor, and nothing else of redeeming nutritional value. And for a product like this, it's really simple. You shouldn't eat a lot of sugar. It's really, really simple. And so that makes them a very easy target as opposed to fast food and other kinds of food, which are high in calories but have nutritional value. Sodas have no nutritional value. Low-hanging fruit. Now, the amount of sugar in sodas is staggering. And even though I've been writing about, I worked on this book for 3 years, I still cannot get my head around how much sugar there is in sugar-sweetened beverages. And the way I finally had to just memorize it, it's 5/6 of a teaspoon per ounce in a standard sugar-sweetened beverage. And so it's a little bit less than a teaspoon per ounce. What that means is if you've got a 12-ounce soda, you've got 10 full teaspoons of sugar. That means you're taking 10 sugar cubes and putting them in, or you're taking 10 packets of sugar. You would never take a glass of water and put that much sugar in water. And yet, because of the way the flavors are balanced, somehow the soda industry has made it possible for us to drink an enormous amount of sugar. What Center for Science and the Public Interest started calling liquid candy some years ago, you would never let your kids eat candy all day long, at least most of us wouldn't, or we wouldn't eat candy all day long. And yet somehow the soda industry has convinced us that it's okay to drink a liquid candy all day long and not consider the consequences. And there are consequences. Now, we know from the dietary guidelines what it is we're supposed to be eating. And the 2015 dietary guidelines were rumored to be coming out last week. They didn't. So now they're going to be rumored to be coming out this week. They're coming out any day if they come out. And I suspect that they will say exactly the same thing as the 2010 dietary guidelines. We're supposed to be eating more fruits and vegetables, lean meats and dairy products, and a lot less junk food and soda. So we know what it is we're supposed to do, and the reason for that has to do with the fact that sodas are among the top sources of calories in American diets. This slide you have to read from right to left. According to the dietary guidelines in 2010, the single largest source of calories in American diets were what the Department of Agriculture loves to call grain-based desserts. Which is their ridiculous name for pies, cookies, Pop-Tarts, donuts, and all of those things that we love eating. And that, because everybody eats those and because so many people eat them, they turn out to be the largest source of calories. Bread is next, fried chicken is next, and sodas is the number four source of calories in the United States diets, greater than pizza, which I find very hard to believe. But that was what the data showed. And then there's alcohol. We won't talk about alcohol. The amount of soda that Americans drink is also pretty staggering. This slide goes from 1980 to the present day, and it's the quantities are given in gallons per capita. Now let me explain that per capita means men, women, old people, little tiny babies. It's across the entire population. And in its peak year, it was a little bit more than 50 gallons per capita per year in the United States, a staggering amount. Since the late 1990s, the amount of soda that people have been drinking per capita has gone down. And it's gone down substantially, so that it's now roughly 35 gallons per capita of sugar sweetened, of total beverages, and of those, about 30 is the sugar sweetened kind, and about 10 or less is diet kind. I'm not going to say too much about diet sodas, but I'll say some things about them. And the thumbs up there is because people are drinking less soda and have been drinking less soda for about 15 years. And believe me, the soda industry is very aware of this. I'm not going to say much about diet soda because it doesn't have sugar in it, but just to show you what's happening with diet soda, all low-calorie sodas are also decreasing in consumption. People are not drinking them as much. They're going down since about 2005, which is around the peak year, and that has to do with increasing public distrust of the chemicals that are in diet soda. I don't particularly like the taste of them. They have this bitter aftertaste. But people are very worried about chemicals in food these days, and so sales of those are down too. And so the soda industry also has to confront that. Now, not everybody drinks soda. If you're like me, you're one of the 50% of the American population that never drinks sugar-sweetened beverages. About 25% of the population drinks between 0 and 1 12-ounce can of soda a day. 20% drinks between 1 and 4, and 5% of the population drinks more than 4 cans a day. And certainly there are people who buy sodas by the liter and just carry it around with them all day long and sip on it constantly. But half the population doesn't drink any at all. And that means that all of the figures on consumption amounts have to be doubled for the half of the population that does drink soda. So if the average consumption for the entire population is one 12-ounce can a day, which is what it is, but half the population doesn't drink any, then the average consumption for the half of the population that does drink soda is 2 cans a day or more, which is really quite a lot. That's 20 teaspoons of sugar right there. Now, that wouldn't be a problem if sugar consumption and soda consumption wasn't highly correlated with obesity and other health consequences. And much of the evidence that links soda to obesity and health consequences is correlational. And here's one of the correlations. These are maps that just came out about the global prevalence of obesity, overweight and obesity. The darker the color, the greater the prevalence, and global soft drink consumption. And these maps are not strictly superimposable, but they're highly correlated. Countries that drink where the population drinks the most soda tend to have the highest prevalence of obesity and vice versa. And there are many areas of the world where there's a great deal of obesity, but there's not much soda consumption, but in general, it's pretty highly correlated. And in fact, if you look at the United States figures, the increase in the overall consumption of soda on a per capita basis between 1980 and 2000 was highly correlated with the rise in obesity during that period. And then since the decrease in soda consumption since about 2000, obesity levels have more or less leveled off a little bit, as shown here. And I've got a thumbs up on that with a question mark on it, because the most recent figures on obesity in the United States are a little bit difficult to interpret. They show an increase, the upper curve here shows an increase in the prevalence of obesity from 2011 to 2012 to 2013 to 2014. There was a rise from 34.9% of the population to 37.7% of the population, but that was not statistically significant. And I wish that I could find a curve that had error bars on it. If you saw the error bars, you would see that they overlap. And so we don't really know whether obesity rates in adults are going up or are staying about the same. And we won't know until the same survey whether the trend is upward or flat. But it's certainly flat for childhood obesity. So that one gets a big thumbs up, because that's a big change. The increase in the prevalence of obesity in childhood was increasing quite a lot until the early 2000s, and now it seems to be leveling off. So that's progress. And the soda consumption is also highly correlated with other conditions. According to any number of studies, if you drink just one soda a day, and that means 12 ounces, it increases the risk of heart disease in men by 20%, increases the risk of diabetes in women by 25%, and for everybody it increases the risk of overweight by 27%, so that's pretty highly correlated, and it increases the risk of stroke by 16%. Now, these are again correlational, and you don't know whether this is causation or whether soda drinking is a marker for other kinds of unhealthful dietary practices. But more and more research is pointing to the fact that soda comes up over and over and over again as something that is highly correlated with an increased risk of disease. And that was the basis of a whole lot of public health advocacy campaigns. This one the one on the right happens to come from Los Angeles, which kind of copied what New York City had done. You wouldn't eat 22 packs of sugar, why are you drinking them? Making the point that you shouldn't be drinking your sugar calories. And then we get to advocacy. And I have a thumbs up for advocacy because advocates have picked on these correlations between soda consumption and public health problems and initiated enormous numbers of advocacy campaigns focused on trying to help people drink less soda and get sugar-sweetened beverages out of their lives. Now, I mentioned earlier that the soda industry is well aware of this, and believe me, they've been aware of it for a very long time. I first came across this in 2007 when the marketing director of Coca-Cola North America gave an interview to Advertising Age in which she said, "Our Achilles heel is obesity. It's just killing us. It used to be that we could just blame obesity on personal responsibility. We're not holding a gun up to your head forcing you to drink sodas. If you drink sodas, it's your choice." And now they can't do that anymore. And already by 2007, they were complaining that their marketing was up against the anti-soda advocacy, and it had become an enormous issue for them. And actually, if you go back and do the research and look at Coca-Cola's filings with the Securities and Exchange Commission, Coca-Cola, like every other publicly traded corporation, is required by law to file with the Securities and Exchange Commission an annual report, which they do at the end of December. And since 2003, so for 12 years now, Coca-Cola has listed as the single leading threat to company profits, obesity and its consequences. So this was the one from 2014. The number one risk factor, obesity concerns may reduce demand for some of our products. They aren't kidding. Researchers, health advocates, dietary guidelines suggest that people would be healthier if they drank less sodas. This is tough for our marketing department to deal with. So they are well aware of the problem, and we'll talk about what they do about it. So one of the things that has happened is that the soda industry has come under increased scrutiny, and this somewhat offensive cover, good heavens, what is it doing? What did that do? Did it just turn around? Weird. Anyway, this is Bloomberg Business Week. Thumbs up on that. The business press is taking a really good hard look at the soda industry to try to examine what it is doing to try to keep its profits up, because that's all the business press cares about. There is also more scrutiny about other practices of the soda industry, one of which is marketing to children. The soda industry has voluntarily said that it will not market to children under the age of 12 on television, on children's television programs, but every evaluation and investigation of the soda industry's marketing practices has shown that it gets to children in lots and lots of other ways, as this report from the Rudd Center showed a couple of years ago. There is also increased scrutiny about the soda industry's relationship with minority communities. And this is a long, long story. I have a chapter in the book called Marketing to African Americans and Hispanics, and I've subtitled A Complicated Story, because it is a complicated story. The history of it goes back more than 50 or 60 years ago, when minority communities demanded that the soda industry advertise to them, advertise in their publications, and hire minority employees as part of their effort. Martin Luther King, on the night before he was assassinated, gave a speech in which he exhorted his followers to boycott Coca-Cola, not because Coca-Cola was marketing to the African-American community and making everybody fat and sick, but because the Coca-Cola was not advertising to the minority community and not hiring African-Americans. So obviously things have changed, and obesity changed that. So there's a very long history of this, and these are some examples of soda company marketing to African-Americans. The soda industry now uses minorities to fight tax campaigns and other public health campaigns. This was a billboard from the Richmond, California soda tax campaign of 2012, in which people from the community pointed out that the tax was unfair and regressive, and it hit poor and working people the hardest, and urged people to vote no, which people in Richmond did. And then here's the Apollo Theater, which Nick just told me that it's still there, but this photo was given to me in November. Here's the Apollo Theater thanking Coca-Cola for its support of the Apollo and the minority and the community around here in Harlem. We also saw this in New York City during Mayor Bloomberg's ill-fated soda cap campaign, in which the many representative organizations representing the African American and Hispanic communities sided with the soda industry against the soda cap initiative, and the New York Times pointed out that these were the very communities hit hardest by obesity and its consequences. And as I said, this has a long history, and the explanation is that the relationship with the soda companies benefited some members of the community, but not others. There's a great deal of advocacy against soda consumption in minority communities now. But the most scrutiny, the places where real scrutiny came up after I had turned this book in and it was in press. And I was just, if the New York Times had only done this 3 months earlier, it would have made my life so much easier. Really so much easier. So this was a front page article that continued over onto a full page on the inside of the paper early in August, in which the New York Times revealed that Coca-Cola was funding an organization at the university, based at the University of Colorado, the Global Energy Balance Network, that was doing research to demonstrate that it really didn't matter how much soda you drank or what you ate. What really mattered was how much exercise you did in obesity. And yes, exercise is very important, and I'm for it. But if you want to manage your weight, you really, really, really have to eat less. And drinking less soda is a good way to start. The idea that Coca-Cola would fund this kind of research, that researchers would take money from Coca-Cola to do this kind of research, and that the university would allow its researchers to take this kind of money, shocked the public. And I know that it shocked the public because I talked to about 30 reporters in the week after this article came out, and I can tell you that the reporters who were not working for the business section of newspapers were truly shocked. Business reporters knew this was going on, and I certainly did because my book is full of such examples. But on this slide, I show that even Fox News was shocked. There was just general shock. So the fallout from this particular article has been amazing to watch. First of all, the cartoonists had a field day, and I wish I could sing because I would sing the Coca-Cola commercial here using these words, but you should be very grateful that I am not doing that. It's the surreal thing. This is just absolutely surreal. And the immediate reaction was that Coca-Cola felt blindsided. I've talked to people who worked at Coca-Cola, and they thought they were funding state-of-the-art exercise physiology facilities at the University of Colorado. It never occurred to them, I'm serious about this, that people would view this as something that was promoting physical activity over drinking less soda. And they were shocked by the reaction. And felt completely blindsided. So they got together. This is a public relations disaster for the company. And the international president of the company, Muhtar Kent, put an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal in which he promised to do better, said that they were going to go completely transparent and totally reveal everybody that they were funding. And he was going to direct Sandy Douglas, who's the president of Coca-Cola North America, to publish a complete list of everybody that they funded and to go on a listening tour and go around and meet with anti-soda advocates and try to find out what they were upset about. I was on his list, so I met him. So they did that. And within short order, they published a list on their website, and if you Google Coca-Cola transparency, you go right to that website, and you too can play with this list. It's an astonishing list. The list of organizations contains nearly 1,000 names, and Coca-Cola called every one of them to make sure that the companies that they and the organizations that they were funding were okay with having this revealed on the website, and there were a few organizations that refused, although not very many. And then they listed all of the health professionals and scientific experts that they were funding, and some group called Ninjas for Health, I have no idea who they are, but they're amazing, did an analysis of the list and found out that 55% of the individuals that Coca-Cola funded were dietitians. Interesting. The list itself lists the organizations and the amount of money, and there were some that were really interesting. So that the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics was getting $700,000, $2.9 million to the American Academy of Pediatrics, $3.5 million to the American Academy of Family Physicians. Now, all three of those organizations are organizations in which there was a fair amount of internal dissent over the last few years over the taking of this money. Certainly, the American Academy of Family Physicians, as I write about in the book, and I've got a photograph of an event that that group held in which physicians burned their membership cards in protest against taking this money from Coca-Cola. The American Academy of Pediatrics also had a lot of pediatricians who were pretty upset about it. And as part of the fallout from this, by the end of September, Coca-Cola had said that it was ending its financial sponsorship of all three organizations. And it's interesting that all three organizations claimed credit for severing the relationship with Coca-Cola. I don't know who initiated it, but it looked to me like Coca-Cola was ending its relationship with organizations where there was substantial controversy within the organization. The next thing that happened was that the University of Colorado returned $1 million grant to the Global Energy Balance Network because it just felt like it was blood money and it wasn't going to take it. So that's kind of amazing. Coca-Cola said that it would take the money and give it to Boys and Girls Clubs of America, which is an organization that Coca-Cola has funded for a long time. Why would Coca-Cola fund the Boys and Girls Club of America? And then, even more amazing, in November, just a few weeks ago, the Associated Press got involved in this, and they filed government records requests from Colorado to get the emails between the researchers and Coca-Cola and discovered that Coca-Cola was intimately involved in the research that was being produced by these investigators. James Hill, who's one of the investigators who was involved in the Global Energy Balance Network, was discovered in an email to be dealing with Coca-Cola executives. I want to help your company avoid the image of being a problem in people's lives and back to being a company that brings important and fun things to them. So that's pretty embarrassing. And the result of that was that the chief Coca-Cola scientist who was involved in all of this and who was the recipient of those emails resigned or was fired, we don't know, resigned. And in the articles about this, it explained that Dr. Rona Applebaum, who'd been with Coca-Cola for a very long time and has worked with the food industry forever, helped pick the group's leaders, create its mission statement and design its website. It also was intimately involved in deciding what kind of research was being done and in dealing with the publication of that research. One of the first examples that I've been able to find of public evidence that food companies that sponsor research are actually involved in the research. It just goes on and on and on. So now we're into October. We're into December. This is December 4th. Coca-Cola said it would no longer fund the Global Energy Balance Network, and the Global Energy Balance Network went out of business. And then more recently in Europe, the Coca-Cola Europe has announced that it's going to do the same thing in Europe that it's done here and make completely transparent the names of all of the organizations that it's funding. And go through the same, and which researchers it's paying. So huge fallout, thumbs up to Coca-Cola for doing this. This is a big step forward. What the company is going to do now, I have no idea. It'll be interesting to see. An editorial in the New York Times the day after that came out talked about how this defense of soda fizzled and congratulated Coca-Cola for doing this and said this whole thing was really shameful to begin with. And New York Magazine, in its naughty and nice section, singled out Coca-Cola as in its naughty section for having funded that in the first place. So I came away from all of this and from a visit to Coca-Cola World, which I did in October, thinking that Coca-Cola and the sugar-sweetened beverage industry is a case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. It's a schizophrenic industry, and these are schizophrenic companies. This is a picture of Sandy Douglas, who I met on his listening tour. He's the nicest person in the world, sincerely interested in trying to make Coca-Cola part of the solution to obesity and not its cause, and I'm serious about this, very sincere. This is Coca-Cola. These are pictures of Coca-Cola World. I particularly love the top photograph because you can see through the window, that's the national headquarters of the American Cancer Society across the street. And on the day that I was there, a very large collection of Tibetan monks was visiting Coca-Cola World. As I said, it's surreal. So Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. So let's talk about the nice Dr. Jekyll. Dr. Jekyll, the Dr. Jekyll part of the company is really interested in making sure that they produce healthier beverages. They're quite aware that the sales of sugar-sweetened beverages are way down. Bottled water is going up. Let's give them a thumbs up on the health side of that. We won't talk about the environmental issues, although I do in the book. But okay, they're making healthier beverages, and they're making beverages in smaller cans and smaller sizes, which is also a thumbs up. The 7.5-ounce mini cans are an interesting business story because they charge a lot of money for them. You can't buy just one. You have to buy them in packs of 6 or 8 or 24 or whatever. On a per-ounce basis, they cost a lot more than the larger sizes. And this is how the company is continuing to make money. It increased its advertising budget last year from $200 to $269 million just in the United States, just for Classic Coke, in order to push the smaller cans. They're enormously profitable. So that's the Dr. Jekyll part. What about Mr. Hyde? Well, unfortunately, behind all the Dr. Jekylls and the public kind, pleasant face of the industry is a lot of really nasty stuff going on behind the scenes. And this was a talk that was given by a guy named Mark Perchuk in California during the Berkeley soda tax campaign, in which he compared big tobacco to big food, in which he showed that big food, just like big tobacco, does front groups, tries to get preemptive legislation, buys friends, buys politicians, has a national strategy, and does all of these behind-the-scenes things in order to protect sales of its products. Coca-Cola has a long history of supporting extraordinarily right-wing conservative groups like ALEC, the group that writes legislation to protect the food industry, and of course the industry puts a fortune into lobbying. This slide shows annual lobbying by PepsiCo, Coca-Cola, and the American Beverage Association. The big peak in 2008 and 2009 occurred when the Senate was considering a soda tax initiative, and in that year, PepsiCo and Coca-Cola increased their lobbying budgets from $2 or $3 million a year to about $10 million a year each, and the American Beverage Association put in another $20 million a year, so that the total amount of lobbying against the soda tax was about $40 million. And the tax failed. The Senate didn't do anything with it. The soda industry is willing to put fortunes into fighting any kind of public health initiative. And we saw that in New York City very, very clearly during Mayor Bloomberg's soda cap campaign. If you recall, the Bloomberg Health Department had the bright idea of putting a 16-ounce cap on the amount of soda that could be, on individual containers of soda that could be sold in the city. That was immediately translated into a ban. So the health department lost the framing war right away. It was framed as a ban from the get-go. And we, you know, here again, the city was surprised at the pushback on it because the city health department viewed the soda cap as a natural extension of what it had been doing for the last 4 or 5 years to try to improve the health of New Yorkers. And here's the list of the various city health campaigns as discussed beautifully by Tom Farley in his book Saving Gotham. There was a ban on cigarettes, a ban on trans fats, requiring of menu labeling, an attempt to tax sodas that failed, an attempt to remove sodas from SNAP that failed, and so then we had the ban on soda sizes, and the most recently is putting warning labels on high-salt foods. So the city was surprised by the pushback on it, and the pushback was enormous. And I would give absolutely anything to know how much money the soda industry spent in New York City to fight the ban, because there was, to fight the cap, because there was really a lot of it. So this is an example of the kind of thing that the city health department was doing in the years leading up to the soda cap initiative. This was the famous photoshopped poster from the health department that showed if you drink larger sizes, then it increases your risk for type 2 diabetes. So the first thing the soda industry did was it started putting a bunch of full-page ads in the New York Times. The first one was to attack the science. That's the first action in the playbook of the cigarette industry, set up this playbook. The first thing you do is attack the science. So the first thing the soda industry did was to attack the science, linking sodas to poor health outcome. And this ad is worth looking at in detail because it lays out all of the soda industry's main arguments about the science, that people don't drink that much, that it only accounts for a small percentage of calories, et cetera, et cetera. Then they defended self-regulation. You don't have to do anything to us. We're taking care of it ourselves. We're self-regulating. We're not marketing to kids under the age of 12 on television. We've taken sodas out of schools. Full sugar sodas out of schools. They don't mention that they did that because they had to, but they did. And then they attacked the critic. And this, of course, is the famous nanny ad that was paid for by the Center for Consumer Freedom. We don't know who was funding the Center for Consumer Freedom to do this. Coca-Cola denies that it supports the Center for Consumer Freedom, and so does PepsiCo. I'm not sure about the American Beverage Association, and I'm quite sure that the National Restaurant Association supports the Center for Consumer Freedom. So this was the ad showing Bloomberg in a dress, and the Bloomberg has a sense of humor, and he was asked about the ads at a press conference later that day, and he said, "Oh, that dress, I would never wear a dress like that. It's so unflattering." good for him. But what really astounded me was the visible presence of anti-cap advertising and methods in New York City. I live in New York. I got a personal mailing to my home. There were ads on. There were trucks all over the place. Don't let bureaucrats tell you what size beverages to buy. There was stuff on radio and TV, airplane banners, T-shirts, movie marquee ads. All over the city, there were people collecting signatures on petitions against the soda cap. And my doctoral student went out and went to Union Square and talked to some of the people who were collecting signatures, asked them who they worked for, and they worked for a front group that had been set up by the American Beverage Association. And he asked them how much they were being paid, and they told him they were being paid $30 an hour. It was the best job in New York. You know. And when all that failed, the soda industry took the city to court and won. And they won on a technicality, but I would like to know how much all of that cost. So the not only the banners, the home mailings, all of the media that was around it, and the legal case alone must have cost an absolute fortune. I sure would like to know the size of that fortune. Now, why is the soda industry willing to put a fortune into what seemed like really small public health measures that it's hard to know whether how big a difference they're going to make? Well, it has to do with the fact that sales are down, and the soda industry is desperate to do something about it, and the most obvious thing that you do following the tobacco industry playbook, if your sales are down, is to move your sales overseas. And that's what this slide, which came out in 2007, showed, was that U.S. sales were down, but everywhere else in the world, they were up. So let me just say something about international efforts to market sugar-sweetened beverages. And these, I've collected these over the last few years, and these are my favorite examples. India has 1.2 billion people, but not enough of them drink Coke. How's that? PepsiCo is going to invest $5.5 billion in India by 2020. $5.5 billion. That's a B, not an M. Coca-Cola moved into Myanmar the minute it opened up. It's investing more than $4 billion in China. PepsiCo has partnerships in Vietnam to try to push sugar-sweetened beverages all over the world. And here is here's an example of how it's done. A student in our department sent this to me. I thought it was a really pretty picture. I like it. But that's in Bangkok, just recently taken. This is how it gets done. Or how's this one from Africa? Coca-Cola loves you, Africa, and Coca-Cola alone is going to spend $29 billion. That's a B, $29 billion. Marketing its products in Africa between 2010 and 2020. That's $3 billion a year in Africa. Targeting Africa's growing middle class. So that's what's happening, and I would be depressed about it if I didn't think the advocacy efforts were having so great an impact. There are organizations all over the place advocating against soda companies on many, many different grounds, for reasons of health, for reasons of child marketing, for reasons of environmental justice in many, many ways. And I've sort of lost count of the number of organizations, although I have a catalog of the main ones in an appendix in the book. I see soda, anti-soda advocacy as part of a much larger food movement. It's only one part of a much greater food movement, and I really wrote the book as the part standing for the whole. I'm really much more interested in the food movement as a whole, of which this is a part, and I think I see it as part of the Occupy movement, but one with a much clearer focus than the Occupy movement has. And the issue of focus is interesting because the really successful anti-soda advocacy has been over the question of soda taxes. And this is a slide from the Berkeley soda tax. And the Berkeley soda tax won by an electoral percentage of 76%. 76% of the voters in Berkeley voted for a soda tax. And that's okay, it's Berkeley. But I think there's much more to it than that. Berkeley did everything right. It followed advocacy by the book. It involved everybody in the community. It left no community members unsolicited and uncanvassed. It brought everybody together around this issue and gave the issue a really successful frame. It was Berkeley against Big Soda. This wasn't a public health issue directly. It was Berkeley against Big Soda, something that resonated very, very well with Berkeley voters. And whenever the soda industry funded a front group or plastered a BART station with anti-tax advertising, everybody could see it was Big Soda flexing its muscle, and they voted against it. An important, important achievement. Mexico also passed a soda tax. And this is also a very important achievement. Mexico has one of the highest per capita consumption of sodas in the world, and also the highest prevalence of obesity. And the there was a big effort to try to scale back the soda tax. It failed, and the soda tax has remained. So it gets a big thumbs up on that. The Guardian did a very careful analysis of why the Mexican soda tax worked, and the reasons were pretty clear. There was really fantastic advocacy. Alejandro Calvillo, who is the head of one of the advocacy groups that's part of this healthy food, the Food Health Alliance, did just a fantastic job of leading this advocacy campaign, helped very much by a $16 million donation from Bloomberg Philanthropies, not inconsiderable. And other kinds of protests are also very, very successful. San Francisco State tried to get rid of its, was about to enter into a pouring rights contract with Coca-Cola to have Coca-Cola be the sole provisioner of sugary sweetened drinks on the campus. Students protested, the president backed down, and that's not going to happen now. And that's all part of what I see as part of this movement. And I want to say something about the movement, because those of you who study social movements and have looked at food movement issues know that there's a major critique of it. And that critique, which has been published in lots and lots of places, say that the food movement has no real power. It's just lots and lots of organizations that are fighting for scarce resources. It's focused on yummy food, not changing the system. It's elitist and perpetuates class and racial inequities, and it's not going to do any good. I see this as a very glass half empty kind of approach, and I completely disagree with this, because I think the food movement gets a lot of credit for a lot of changes that have taken place in our food system over the last 20 years. People who are young may not be able to see these changes over 20 years, but I certainly can. I think we have better food absolutely everywhere, and I have a great big long list here of all the things that are going on that I think represent real change. If you go back 20 years, we didn't have these things, and now we do. And among these, I mean, the food companies all over the place are taking the junk out of their products, the additives, the we have less soda consumption, and of course my favorite is we have more food studies programs, of which this is a very good example, the Hunter Food Policy Group. So these are, you know, and let them flourish. Let's have more and more and more of these. They're happening everywhere. When we started our food studies program at NYU in 1996, we were it, basically. And now there are about 80 colleges in the United States that have food studies programs in one form or another. The forms differ, but they're all focused on food system change. Another big change is that many of the organizations that originally focused on let's get yummy food to more people, buy fresh, buy local, or slow food, are now increasingly engaging in politics. We'll Vote for Food Policy Action is the one that's most clearly aimed at that, but there's much more understanding among these food advocacy organizations that they have to engage with the political system if they're going to make real change. And it's not just a matter of individual choice, but it's real. It is really focused on system change. So here's my list of things that need system changing. And there are lots and lots of groups working on many of these issues, all the way from agriculture policy to public health policy. And of course, what we want is to link agriculture policy to public health policy so that both are considered in making decisions about what kind of political change we enter into. And these are the kinds of things I talk about in this book and in my previous books. So I thank you very, very much for the opportunity to talk to you about this today. Thanks. I think I can take questions, comments, brickbats, whatever you want to throw. Anybody have anything to say? Yes.
I was interested in the increase in spending on the continent of Africa that you talked about by Coca-Cola. Is most of that probably for sugary soda drinks, or might some of it be for some of the more healthy, supposedly, drinks that they are going to be
using? Sugar-sweetened beverages are 70% of sales in the United States. In other countries where they don't drink diet drinks, it's much greater. So, and they're by far the more profitable. Now, why they are more profitable is something I really don't understand, but that's what they tell me. So yes, they're pushing other kinds of things. And if you go to Coca-Cola World, which I highly recommend, you pay $16 to get into it, and then you're advertised too for as long as you stay there, and you exit through the gift shop, which is an amazing place. But there's a tasting room, and we tasted 50 different soft drinks from all over the world, some with sugar, some not. And I have to tell you, classic Coca-Cola tastes better than any of them. It's a problem. So, yeah.
Hi, my name's Triada Stampus. I work for Food Bank for New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Good to see you here, and thank you for this very entertaining and really great lecture. One thing that always sort of like bedevils me when, especially when looking at the parallels between the sugar-sweetened beverage campaigns for and against and tobacco is, you know, at this point in time, the research is in on the dangers of tobacco, and if many places have taxed cigarettes really deeply to discourage participation, and yet consumption is still, or use of tobacco products is still disproportionate among low-income populations. And so the people who you would think would be most price sensitive to any kinds of purchases and therefore most sensitive to taxing are still disproportionately using it. And I'm wondering, if we parallel that to soda, if there are any areas of public health research or practice that you think need further exploration to kind of dig into why things like that still happen, why choices, you know, what in the lives of low-income people still drive to a disproportionate extent the use of products that most people agree is really bad. Because I think also the general awareness of the dangers of soda, or the risks of soda consumption and the public health problems of soda consumption are fairly well known at this point.
Mm-hmm. Marketing, in a word? No, this is, the marketing is targeted to these communities. Look at who the spokespeople are for the soda companies. PepsiCo has a $50 million deal with Beyonce. The sports figures, the soccer, the, there's the list of sports organizations that are funded by Coca-Cola is staggering, and these are, you know, these are people that people look up to. There's more money going into low-income communities than there is in other places. They're advertising on programs that are watched by low-income communities. I don't think it's very complicated. And if you want to counter that, you have a great deal of community organizing to do, which is difficult. And even though public health said, you know, public health in theory, you know, the way you're supposed to make change in public health is you go into a community, you work with the community, you find out what the community wants, you help the community get what it wants, and you stand back. You don't come in and tell people what to do. That's not how it works in practice often. So I think the main thing that needs doing is a great deal more effort on community organizing. If we're going to make these kinds of changes, yeah.
Good morning again.
Good morning.
I wrote something down so I can keep my thought pattern. My name is Diana Blackwell. I'm from Fred Samuel Resident Association, part of the New York City Housing Authority, NYCHA. And I would like to say this, I do have a small-scale green and health initiative in my low-income minority neighborhood. It is a health, considered a health disparity area because we have high rates of diabetes, stroke, hypertension, and heart attack. And I want to say this. I hear what you're saying, but there has yet to be a plan implemented that's really going to address this issue in our neighborhood. And I know you're doing a great job. You're doing a great job. But let me just share this. What drives the huge and continued consumption of soda is the lack of money and jobs, as well as affordable, healthy choices. I have to acknowledge my borough president, Gail Brewer, who is working with me on my small initiative. And I believe that education is a way to change our minds, and that works with me. But to the families in my community, which includes two homeless shelters within two blocks, it's kind of hard to get them involved. They're going to go for the sugary drink. It fills them, fills their stomach. It gives them some type of comfort. So it's going to be kind of hard to reach them. So I would like to ask you, you know, please consider this information when going forward in the part of your movement.
Oh, I mean, obviously, when I was in public health school, I spent a year working with the Coalition of Homeless Shelter Providers in San Francisco, and I'll never forget one of the street people that who was part of this coalition asked me if I would come give a talk in a homeless shelter about nutrition. I thought, well, what a complete waste of time this is going to be. But he wanted me to do it, so I did. And one of the people who was resident in the shelter got up and said, "Ms. Nutrition," he said, "don't talk to us. Talk to the soup kitchen across the street." And of course he was perfectly right. He wasn't in control of his own food. The soup kitchen was in control of his food, and that was a whole additional story. So thanks for pointing that out. Obviously, what everybody needs is jobs and more money. That would solve a lot of problems. Nick.
First, thank you for the talk. It was great. I wanted to react to the comment, the comparison to tobacco earlier, and then ask a question. And I think the similarities and differences between tobacco, alcohol, and food are interesting. Actually, I think
he wrote a great book about that.
The use rates of tobacco and alcohol in African American and Latino communities are lower than in white communities. But what is true is the adverse health consequences in those communities, because their health is more compromised in many ways or greater. And so we need to understand those differences, and I think it would be interesting to see what that is in food. Where are the healthier patterns of food use in poor communities? How can we build on those? And then what are the lack of resources in other areas that aggravate some of those problems? But the question is in a different arena. We're having a national election next year, and I wonder if you have ideas about where food policy, soda, can enter into both the congressional and presidential election. What openings do you see, and do you have any suggestions?
Well, I don't see any openings at the national level that are meaningful at all at this point. I think everything has to be at the local level. And what I'm seeing, or at least what I think I'm seeing, is that as these local initiatives are taking place all over the country, it puts the food companies in the position of having to go to Congress and lobby for preemptive laws. And you know, we're seeing that with GMO labeling is the most obvious example right now. But from the standpoint of anti-soda advocacy, I just don't see it with this election at all. You know, if this president, and who came in with a very strong public health agenda around food, because Michelle Obama took it on in her Let's Move campaign, was able to make some progress, but was just fought at every single step of the way. I mean, it was just such an uphill battle. I just don't see it. When we have candidates who are so far on the right that you can't even get to the middle. The middle seems really left-wing these days. So I don't see it. I know that Michael Pollan and Mark Bittman and Ricardo Salvador did this piece for, I think the Washington Post, I'm not sure where they published it, on a food policy for the incoming president. And I thought their piece was interesting. I thought it was way too long and not focused enough to really get through. But the one thing I would have emphasized in it was, let's get a food policy czar somewhere in the government who can look at these things and try to bring the disparate elements together and try to set up a step-by-step approach to bringing agricultural policy in line with health policy, which is where I think this really needs to go. So I would say this is a long-term effort starting now, moving forward, but I'm not very optimistic that anything can be done on the federal level. On the other hand, lots can be done on the local level, lots. And there are communities all over the country that are trying to address these issues one way or another. And if more and more and more of them do, that's going to force the federal government to follow suit. In the same way that New York City did trans fat way ahead of anybody else, and did menu labeling way ahead of anybody else. And then it went national. So, I mean, I think that's the... You know, that's the strategic vision for this. But, you know, the chief anti-hunger advocates in the House can't get anywhere. Nobody's interested in anti-hunger, they say. So there you are. Depressing. He who has the microphone has the floor.
Thank you. My name is Hank Kornfeld. I'm a recent Master of Food Technology graduate. Mm-hmm. Last Thursday, I defended my thesis.
Congratulations.
Thank you. The role of artificial sweeteners in obesity.
Mm-hmm.
I think you made about 100 good points, but I have some criticisms, I think, mm-hmm. to be fair. You mentioned obesity and global salt consumption as linked. And I think, to be fair, we have to question whether there is a direct causal relationship there.
I didn't say there was.
Well, but I think it's important that the implications, mm-hmm. which come out very frequently, and I'm not criticizing you necessarily, but I think in general there has to be some understanding of the of what should be a neutrality, and I think it's very obvious not. I also should probably divulge some memberships. Slow food, old ways, and Center for Science. So I'm not leaning one way or the other, but just as a food scientist, trying to look at a very neutral approach to this. As far as criticizing Coke, Pepsi, Dr. Pepper, they're businesses. I think it's unrealistic for us to expect that they're going to do anything but try to drive their business. And I just think that needs to be an understanding to begin with, whether what they're doing is right or wrong, beneficial or not, their business. They have to respond to their shareholders. And how do we manipulate that? How do we change that? It's a question. Another thing about Coke sponsorship of studies, while highly questionable, is there a direct link or direct impact that they have on how the studies are conducted and the results of the studies? I think we need to be careful with how we state that they are or are not, or perhaps phrase it as they may be. I think they certainly could be, but we don't know. But that's my thought.
Yeah, actually we do know. As a result of the Global Energy Balance Network emails. If you read the emails, it's perfectly clear that Ron Applebaum was involved in the research and the research results. You know, I've been collecting industry-funded studies on my website since last March, and I just started this as a sort of a non-scientific, any study that came across my desk that was funded by a food company, I just looked to see whether its results were favorable to the food company's marketing interests or not. And as of today, I've posted 90 studies with results favorable to the food company's interest that could be used in marketing. And I've only found 9 that come out with results that are unfavorable. So it's a coincidence, and it's not a very scientific study. But I think that in the case of Coca-Cola studies, every study that has been funded by Coca-Cola that I've been able to find in the last year has come out with results that show that Coca-Cola has no effect on obesity, it's got no effect on type 2 diabetes, it's exercise not what you're eating that makes a difference in obesity. And then the part that I am most upset about is that there has been a deliberate attack by Coca-Cola-funded studies on the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, which is the main survey from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that links, that looks at diet and health and links soda consumption to obesity, type 2 diabetes, and other correlational, but highly correlated. There has just been a deliberate attempt by Coca-Cola and American Beverage Association funded studies to demonstrate that the methods used in the NHANES survey are so poor that you could just ignore them. And in my conversations with the head of Coca-Cola in North America and discussing the kind of research that they're funding, I told him I didn't think he should be funding that kind of research. That was just not good for the company. Of course the company is a business, and that's why they're pushing the small cans that they make lots of money from, and that's why they're spending $29 billion in Africa. That's how the system works. Thank you for that. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Karishma. I'm currently a dietetic student and also part of the Greater New York Dietetics Association. Mm-hmm. So this is just asking for your insight, your opinion. Where do we keep our faith? Because you showed a slide where about the Coca-Cola transparency, and 55% of the dietitians are receiving funding from Coca-Cola.
No, 55% of the people who are receiving money from Coca-Cola are dietitians.
And then some of the money was also going to Academy of Nutrition mm-hmm. and Dietetics.
Mm-hmm.
Who do we trust?
Dietitians for Professional Integrity. That one's easy.
I know, but
you've got an organization that you can join. It's called Dietitians for Professional Integrity. Just go online and go join it.
It seems that it's really hard to sometimes even trust dietitians and doctors. In my classes, of course, my teachers have brought articles where dietitians have said, yes, we should have sugary breakfast and danishes and croissants and and then I see the slide, and then I see out there in low-income communities that it's very hard for them to not buy sodas because they are cheap. And yes, Coca-Cola is bringing out those smaller cans, but then you mentioned also they're a little bit more expensive. You can't just buy one. You have to buy several. Do you ever feel defeated? You know, do you ever feel that you're losing the battle?
Well, I gave lots and lots of examples of things that I think are really making progress. I mean, you can't expect all of it at once. You have to stepwise. But if you're a dietitian, you can join Dietitians for Professional Integrity, which is a group that was set up to oppose corporate funding of the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. So you've got something from within the organization that you can join to where you can work from within. And that's a real opportunity, it seems to me. So, two more questions. Whoever has the microphone.
I luckily have the mic. Peter Lehner with Earth Justice. Your previous slide had a number of advocacy targets for agriculture and mm-hmm. food. If you could just go back to that for a minute and give what perhaps would be your thoughts of the most successful. You mentioned Berkeley is very successful. Mm-hmm. What would be your priorities or your thoughts of the most likely opportunities for the next couple of years on this page?
Yeah, I mean, it's very hard to know what's going to work. I mean, obviously something is working because soda sales are way down. So something is working. I think it's in the national zeitgeist, you know, that everybody knows that sodas are bad for you, and everybody who can stop drinking them and isn't in a personal culture, surrounded by a personal culture in which everybody is drinking sodas, could stop drinking sodas. In much the same way that people who could stop smoking did stop smoking when the early anti-smoking advocacy started. So it's very hard to know. I mean, these are sort of listed in order of increasing difficulty, in a way. So I think you can do something about neighborhood access to healthier food pretty easily if you're working in a city that is interested in this sort of thing. Schools are an easy one, although some of you who are working in schools may not think so. And let me just say about schools that the issue about schools is that they're personal. It's who the particular configuration of the individuals is that's working in that school. If you have a principal, a school food service director, some teachers and some parents who are interested in having healthier food, you've got healthier food. If you don't, you're in real trouble and it's an uphill battle. But schools are not so hard. The safety net for the poor is obviously very difficult, especially these days where there's so much political opposition to doing anything for the poor, marketing to kids. The industry has said that's a line in the sand beyond which they will not go. They will not stop marketing to kids because it'll put them out of business. So that's a tough one. Restaurant workers, who would ever guess that higher wages for restaurant workers would be something that was actually going to happen? It looks like that one's going to happen. Taxes and size caps, I'd like to see somebody else try a size cap thing. I thought it was a good idea. The only thing wrong with it was it's too big. It should have been capped at 8 ounces, in my view. You know, and then we get into campaign funding laws, which is the root of all evil in American society. And to do something about that, we have to do something about the Supreme Court. That's very difficult. Now, overturn Citizens United and McCutcheon and so forth. You know, I think a lot of the problem is the way Wall Street evaluates corporations. It used to be, you know, when I was growing up, there was IBM and blue chip stocks. Remember blue chip stocks? You never hear about them anymore. These were stocks that gave long, slow returns on investment. Very long, very slow. That changed in 1981 with the shareholder value movement, where shareholders said they wanted higher immediate returns on investment. And the result of that is that Wall Street requires companies not only to make a profit every 90 days, but to grow their profit every 90 days. That's impossible for food companies because we have roughly 4,000 calories a day per capita, men, women, little tiny babies. And that's twice the food that the population needs on the whole. That's part of the reason why there's so much waste. So there's twice the number of calories that anybody needs. It just makes the food industry hugely competitive. And to require all food companies to grow their profits, or all publicly traded ones, is an unreasonable expectation. It just puts too much pressure on them. And then holding corporates accountable. I mean, that's part of what I think the anti-soda movement is doing, is holding these companies accountable for the effect of their products on public health. And the soda companies have admitted that they know that their products consumed in excess contribute to obesity. Do they cause obesity? No, they contribute to it. How much they contribute depends on everything else everybody else is doing. It's tough, but holding them accountable seems like a good idea. There's also and then all the agriculture ones, but there's also a difference in advocacy about advocacy that's focused on specific goals and advocacy that's focused on communication. And no matter what you do on any of these things, you're increasing the communication level and bringing more and more people into the fold and getting them involved in these kinds of issues. I think it's a good thing. And it's very hard to know how it will all end up. But I'm watching it. It's fun to watch. And I think one last question, whoever has it.
Hi, I'm Linda LaViolette. I'm Director of Farmers Markets and on the Governor's Food Policy Council. I'd like to thank you for being a good food advocate. You're just what we need. And I'd like to recognize Kathy Nones, who also has been really responsible for promoting My question really concerns access to good food and the SNAP program. One issue I've had with a lot of really good advocacy organizations like Food Research Action Center and Hunger Solutions is that they sort of oppose a ban on soft drinks or the SNAP program. And I wonder if you could comment on that.
I have a chapter in my book on exactly that. The way that I frame it is that the soda industry has divided the anti-hunger community quite effectively into it's divided the anti-hunger from the anti-obesity advocates, because the anti-obesity advocates want to get sodas out of SNAP, and the anti-hunger community is just dug in. Now, the anti-hunger community gets a great deal of funding from the soda and industry and other food companies, but I don't think that's a sufficient explanation. It's a partial explanation. If you talk to anti-hunger advocates privately, off camera, and confidentially, they will tell you that their big worry about the any kind of initiative that's going to change the SNAP package, the SNAP eligibility package, is that Congress will use it as an excuse to cut the program. And I think they're right. There's plenty of evidence that Congress is quite eager to cut SNAP benefits. And so it's a very tricky kind of thing. And in talking to people in Congress about could we change the SNAP eligibility package, the other great opposition to that package is the retailers. You know, you want to understand why Duane Reade, Walgreens, and all of these what used to be pharmacies have suddenly looked like food stores is because they've made their stores eligible for SNAP purchases. They have just exactly the number of products that they need in order to qualify as a SNAP for SNAP benefits. So it's really complicated, but I see it as the food industry deliberately, you know, dividing this community. And the community needs to be brought back together to make this work. How we do that, I'm not sure. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Okay. Thank you. Maybe to end on one more half full note, it was this weekend in Paris that the world climate change movement pressured governments from around the world to come to agreement. Not solving the problem fully, but I think in the view of most observers, a real step forward, and very connected to the campaigns around food. And let's also take hope that the local and the global arenas for action offer very promising opportunities. Thank you all so much for coming. Welcome to our site. See you in Boston. I'm
Sorry.
Well, I'm actually going to grab that off.
I think somebody wants to take a picture.
I'll